Jerusalem in the midst of many thousands, who according to the law, came up to worship upon that occasion, not only from Judea, but from nations very remote. I dreaded no harm at the hands of a few illiterate fishermen, having not been informed that any of the rulers, or of the scribes and Pharisees had believed in Jesus, and therefore was at no pains to prevent the multitude coming up to the solemnity as usual. But here was another shock my kingdom sustained, for Peter the fisherman, who so very lately like a dastard impiously denied his Lord with profane oaths, now filled with the Holy Ghost, stood up in the midst, and clearly proved that Jesus was the very Messiah, and upon this occasion played off the heavy artillery of Sinai on the consciences of my people, which was attended with success so fatal to me, that no less than 3,000 were pierced through the heart at once, and fell on the field of action. Now it was that my evil apprehensions were again alarmed, plainly perceiving that the artillery of the word was leveled against my person, and that the first end of the gospel was the subversion of my diabolical government. However, I drew up all the forces which I possibly could in the hurry of that surprise, and had just time to give one general discharge, my soldiers crying out as they gave the volley, "These men are drunken with new wine." It was but a poor opposition to doctrine so powerful, I allow, but it was the best that could at that time be made, for we were obliged to retreat in much confusion, and leave the Christian fishermen masters of the field. As soon as we were a little recovered from the disorder into which that unexpected misfortune had plunged us, I summoned a council of war, in which the self-righteous Jews were the principal, next to our infernal train. I myself gave special orders that some method should be concerted effectually to destroy the name of Jesus, for, said I, if we let them alone, all the people will believe in their doctrine. In this council, it was resolved to raise an army of those who were the greatest adversaries to the name of Jesus, to whom orders should be given to kill, destroy, and cause to perish all who believed in this way, till the Christian religion should be banished from the face of the earth. This army was raised, and the command given to Saul of Tarsus, at that time a mighty zealous for us, and who for a season made a dreadful havoc of all that believed contrary to the faith of the priests, for it ought to be observed, that the opinion of the priests has been esteemed true orthodoxy and the only faith, in all ages and countries. But here another sad disappointment and loss befell me, for as this same Captain Saul was on his march to Damascus to fight a pitched battle with the Christians, it so fell that Emmanuel himself was taking a tour in the valley to see how the pomegranates budded, and falling in with trusty Saul on his journey, unveiled his own personal excellencies to him, and laid him under an immediate arrest. As soon as he saw the beauties of Emmanuel, he felt the most sincere esteem for his person, and conceived the most exalted sentiments of friendship and love. Yea, he was even so much grieved that ever he had drawn his sword against him, that he renounced the service of 42 infidels on the spot, took the oath of allegiance to Jesus, and thenceforward hated my person and government with the most perfect hatred, and did what he could to overturn our state and subvert our government. Bookmark Farnese.a. Farnese, forgotten mystic amanuensis, to Francesco. A wanderer in the spirit lands, by Francesco, through amanuensis Farnese. With a Farnese, we encroach upon a word, which was often used in the 19th century to describe a person who had a special relationship with one particular soul in the spirit world who would show them visions of the afterlife and teach them regarding the laws and mechanisms of the world beyond. A. Farnese was one of these, although there were quite a few. One of the more well-known of these was Philos the Tibetan, whose work A Dweller on Two Planets is kept in print by a small following even today, though it was written by amanuensis, Yalgoro, in the 19th century, as well. In this better-known work, Philos tells the story of many of his lifetimes going back to the time of Atlantis and explains the mechanisms of karma. But in our forgotten mystic's work, the theme is the other life, the world beyond, and Francesco takes him on many journeys to this world and teaches him about the laws that abide within it. As with many of our forgotten mystics, not much is known all about his life. He left a short note about the nature of his work in his work A Wandering in the Spirit World, which is also known by the title A Wanderer in the Spirit Lands. The following narrative was written more than a year ago, and in giving it to the public I do not claim to be its author, since I have only acted the part of an amanuensis and endeavored to write down as truthfully and as carefully as I could the words given to me by the spirit author himself, who is one of several spirits who have desired me to write down for them their experiences in the spirit world. I have had to write the words as fast as my pen could travel over the paper, and many of the experiences described and opinions advanced are quite contrary to what I myself believed to be in accordance with the conditions of life in the world of spirits. The spirit author Francesco so I have frequently seen materialized, and he has been recognized on these occasions by friends who knew him in earth life. Having given the narrative to the public as I received it from the spirit author, I must leave with him all responsibility for the opinions expressed and the scenes described. All that is known all about what brought Farnese to the transformation into mystic hood is written in two accounts he included in his writings. 1. My death, and 2. My second death. My death. I have been a wanderer through a far country, in those lands that have no name, no place, for you of earth, and I would set down as briefly as I can my wanderings, that those whose feet are pointed to that bourne may know what may in their turn await them. On earth and in my life of earth I lived as those do who seek only how the highest point of self-gratification can be reached. If I was not unkind to some, if I was indulgent to those I loved, yet it was ever with the feeling that they in return must minister to my gratification, that from them I might purchase by my gifts and my affection the love and homage which was as my life to me. I was talented, highly gifted both in mind and person, and from my earliest years the praise of others was ever given to me, and was ever my sweetest incense. No thought ever came to me of that all self, sacrificing love which can sink itself so completely in the love for others that there is no thought, no hope of happiness, but in securing the happiness of the beloved ones. In all my life, and amongst those women whom I loved, as men of earth too often miscall that which is but a passion too low and base to be dignified by the name of love, amongst all those women who from time to time captivated my fancy, there was not one who ever appealed to my higher nature sufficiently to make me feel this was true love, this the ideal for which in secret I sighed. In everyone I found something to disappoint me. They loved me as I loved them, no more, no less. The passion I gave won but its counterpart from them, and thus I passed on unsatisfied, longing for I knew not what. Mistakes I made, ah! How many sins I committed, not a few, yet the world was often at my feet to praise me and call me good, and noble, and gifted. I was fated, caressed, the spoilt darling of the dames of fashion. I had but to woo to win, and when I won all turned to bitter ashes in my teeth. And then there came a time upon which I shall not dwell, when I made the most fatal mistake of all and spoilt two lives where I had wrecked but one before. It was not a golden flowery wreath of roses that I wore, but a bitter chain, fetters as of iron that galled and bruised me till at last I snapped them asunder and walked forth free. Free? Ah, me! Never again should I be free, for never for one moment can our past errors and mistakes cease to dog our footsteps and clog our wings while we live, aye, and after the life of the body is ended, till one by one we have atoned for them, and thus blotted them from our past. And then it was, when I deemed myself secure from all love, when I thought I had learned all that love could teach, knew all that woman had to give, that I met one woman. Ah! What shall I call her? She was more than mortal woman in my eyes, and I called her the good angel of my life, and from the first moment that I knew her I bowed down at her feet and gave her all the love of my soul, of my higher self, a love that was poor and selfish when compared to what it should have been, but it was all I had to give, and I gave it all. For the first time in my life I thought of another more than of myself, and though I could not rise to the pure thoughts, the bright fancies that filled her soul, I thank God I never yielded to the temptation to drag her down to me. As so time went on, I sunned myself in her sweet presence, I grew in holy thoughts that I deemed had left me forever, I dreamed sweet dreams in which I was freed from those chains to my past that held me so cruelly, so hardly, now when I sought for better things. And from my dreams I ever woke to the fear that another might win her from me, and to the knowledge that I, alas, but I could find no light, hear no sound. There was nothing but the stillness, the darkness of death around me. Then I thought I would walk forward and find the door. I could move, though slowly and feebly, and I groped on, for how long I know not. It seemed hours, for in my growing horror and dismay I felt I must find someone, some way out of this place, and to my despair I seemed never to find any door, any wall, anything. All seemed space and darkness round me. Overcome at last, I called out aloud. I shrieked, and no voice answered me. Then again and again I called, and still the silence, still no echo, even from my own voice, came back to cheer me. I bethought me of her I loved, but something made me shrink from uttering her name there. Then I thought of all the friends I had known, and I called on them, but none answered me. Was I in prison? No. A prison has walls and this place had none. Was I mad? Delirious. What? I could feel myself, my body. It was the same. Surely the same? No. There was some change in me. I could not tell what, but I felt as though I was shrunken and deformed. My features, when I passed my hand over them, seemed larger, coarser, distorted surely. Oh, for a light. Oh, for anything to tell me even the worst that could be told. Would no one come? Was I quite alone? And she, my angel of light, oh! Where was she? Before my sleep she had been with me, where was she now? Something seemed to snap in my brain and in my throat and I called wildly to her by name, to come to me, if but for once more. I felt a terrible sense as if I had lost her, and I called and called to her wildly, and for the first time my voice had a sound and rang back to me through that awful darkness. Before me, far, far away, came a tiny speck of light like a star that grew and grew and came nearer and nearer till at last it appeared before me as a large ball of light, in shape like a star, and in the star I saw my beloved. Her eyes were closed as of one in sleep, but her arms were held out to me and her gentle voice said in those tones I knew so well, "Oh, my love, where are you now? I cannot see you, I only hear your voice. I only hear you call to me, and my soul answers to yours." I tried to rush to her, but I could not. Some invisible force held me back, and around her seemed a ring I could not pass through. In an agony I sank to the ground, calling upon her to leave me no more. Then she seemed to grow unconscious, her head sank upon her breast, and I saw her float away from me as though some strong arms had borne her. I sought to rise and follow her, but could not. It was as if a great chain held me fast, and after some fruitless struggles I sank upon the ground in unconsciousness. My second death. The meetings for materialization were held once a fortnight, and from the number of them I judged that about 3 months had passed, when I was told by a Rinziman to prepare myself for a great change which was about to take place in myself and my surroundings, and which would mean my passing into a higher sphere. I have heard the spheres divided differently by different spirit teachers, and it is not very important that they should be all divided by the same standard, since these divisions are very similar to mapping out a country where the boundaries melt so imperceptibly into one another that it is not very essential to have the limits defined with perfect exactitude, since the changes in the countries and the people will of themselves mark their different states as you progress on your journey. Thus, then, some will tell you there are 7 spheres and that the 7th means the heaven spoken of in the Bible, others say there are 12 spheres, others again extend the number. Each sphere is, however, divided into circles, usually 12 to a sphere, though here again some spirits will reckon them differently, Just as your standards of measurement on Earth differ in different countries, yet the thing they measure remains the same. For myself, I have been used to count that there are 7 spheres above the Earth and 7 below it, using the terms above and below as signifying the nearness to, or distance from, the great central sun of our solar system, the nearest point of attraction towards that sun being considered to be our highest point of attainment, while in the limits of the Earth's spheres, and the farthest away being regarded as our lowest or most degraded sphere. Each sphere, then, being subdivided into 12 circles, which are blended so closely into each other that you appear to pass almost insensibly from one to the other. I had hitherto been in what is called the Earth plane, which like a great broad belt circles around the Earth and permeates its atmosphere. This Earth plane may be said to comprehend within its bounds the first of the 7 spheres above and the first of those below the Earth, and is used commonly in describing the habitations of those spirits who are said to be earthbound in a greater or less degree because they are not able to sink below the Earth attractions nor to free themselves from its influences. I was now told that I had so far freed myself from the Earth's attractions and overcome my desires for earthly things that I was able to pass into the second sphere. The passing from the body of the lower sphere into that of a higher one is often, though not invariably, accomplished during a deep sleep which closely resembles the death, sleep of the spirit in leaving the earthly body. As a spirit grows more elevated, more etherealized, this change is accompanied by a greater degree of consciousness, till at last the passing from one high sphere to another is simply like changing one garb for another a little finer, discarding one spiritual envelope for a more ethereal one. Thus the soul passes onward, growing less and less earthly, or material, in its envelopment, till it passes beyond the limits of our earth spheres into those of the solar systems. It happened, then, that upon my return from one of my visits to the Earth, I felt overpowered by a strange, unusual sense of drowsiness, which was more like paralysis of the brain than sleep. I retired to my little room in the Twilight Land, and throwing myself upon my couch, sank at once into a profound dreamless slumber like unto the unconscious sleep of death. In this state of unconsciousness I lay for about 2 weeks of earthly time, and during it my soul passed from the disfigured astral body and came forth like a newborn child, clothed in a brighter, purer spiritual envelope, which my efforts at overcoming the evil in myself had created for it. Only I was not born as an infant but as a full-grown man, even as my experience and knowledge had been those of mature spirit. There are some mortals whose knowledge of life is so limited, whose minds have been so little cultivated, and whose natures are so simple and childlike, that they are born into the spirit world as mere children, however many years of earth life they may have known. But it was not so with me, and in assuming my new condition I also possessed the development in age which my earth life had given me. In a state of perfect unconsciousness my newborn soul was borne by the attendant spirit friends into the second sphere, where I lay sleeping my dreamless sleep till the time came for my awakening. The discarded astral envelope I had left was by the power of attendant spirits dissolved into the elements of the earth plane, even as my earthly body left at my first death would decay into the earthly material from which it had been taken, dust returning unto dust again, while the immortal soul passed on to a higher state. Thus did I pass through my second death and awake to the resurrection of my higher self. Farnese's writings present such a thorough and fascinating view of both the heavenly and hellish realms. We hope you enjoy this interesting journey into another yet forgotten wanderer in the spirit lands. Excerpts from A Wandering in the Spirit World, by Francesco through A. Farnese. Twilight Lands, Love's Gifts, The Valley of Selfishness, The Country of Unrest, The Miser's Land, The Gambler's Land. When my period of work in any place was finished, I used to return to the Twilight Land to rest in another large building which belonged to our brotherhood. It was somewhat like the other place in appearance, only not quite so dark, nor so dismal, nor so bare. And in the little room which belonged to each there were such things as we had earned as the rewards of our labors. For instance, in my room, which was still somewhat bare, looking, I had one great treasure. This was a picture of my love. It seemed more like a reflection of her in a mirror than a mere painted image, for when I looked intently at her she would smile back at me in answer, as though her spirit was conscious of my gaze, and when I wished very much to know what she was doing, my picture would change and show me. This was regarded by all my companions as a great and wonderful privilege, and I was told it was as much the result of her love and constant thought for me as of my own efforts to improve. Since then I have been shown how this living image was thrown upon the light of the astral plane and then projected into its frame in my room, but I cannot explain it more fully in this book. Another gift from my darling was a white rose, bud, which I had in a small vase and which never seemed to fade or wither, but remained fresh and fragrant and ever an emblem of her love, so that I called her my white rose. I had so longed for a flower. I had so loved flowers on earth and I had seen none since I saw those my darling put upon my grave. In this land there were no flowers, not even a leaf or blade of grass, not a tree or a shrub however this twilight sky overhead. Here again not a blade of grass, not one poor stunted shrub was to be seen, not one touch of color or brightness anywhere, only this dull desolation of gray stones. Those who dwelt in this valley had centered their lives and their affections in themselves and had shut up their hearts against all the warmth and beauty of unselfish love. They had lived only for themselves, their own gratification, their own ambitions, and now they saw nothing but themselves and the gray desolation of their hard, selfish lives around them. There were a great many beings flitting uneasily about in this valley. But strange to say they had been so centered in themselves that they had lost the power to see anyone else. These unhappy beings were invisible to each other until such time as the thought of another and the desire to do something for someone besides themselves should awaken, when they would become conscious of those near to them, and through their efforts to lighten another's lot they would improve their own, till at last their stunted affections would expand and the hazy valley of selfishness would hold them in its chains no more. Beyond this valley I came upon a great, dry, sandy-looking tract of country where there was a scanty straggling vegetation, and where the inhabitants had begun in some places to make small attempts at gardens near their habitations. In some places these habitations were clustered so thickly together that they formed small towns and cities. But all bore that desolate ugly look which came from the spiritual poverty of the inhabitants. This also was a land of selfishness and greed, although not of such complete indifference to others' feelings as in the Grey Valley, and therefore they sought for a certain amount of companionship even with those around them. Many had come from the Grey Valley, but most were direct from the earth life and were now, poor souls, struggling to rise a little higher, and wherever this was the case and an effort was made to overcome their own selfishness, then the dry soil around their homes would begin to put forth tiny blades of grass and little stunted shoots of shrubs. Such miserable hovels as were in this land. Such ragged, repulsive, wretched-looking people, like tramps or beggars, yet many had been amongst earth's wealthiest and most eminent in fashionable life, and had enjoyed all that luxury could give. But because they had used their wealth only for themselves and their own enjoyments, giving to others but the paltry crumbs that they could spare from their own wealth and hardly notice that they had given them, because of this, I say, they were now here in this twilight land, poor as beggars in the true spiritual wealth of the soul which may be earned in the earthly life alike by the richest king or the poorest beggar, and without which those who come over to the spirit land, be they of earth's greatest or humblest, must come here to dwell where all are alike poor in spiritual things. Here some of the people would wrangle and quarrel and complain that they had not been fairly treated in being in such a place, seeing what had been their positions in earth life. They would blame others as being more culpable than themselves in the matter, and wake a thousand excuses, a thousand pretenses, to anyone who would listen to them and the story of what they would call their wrongs. Others would still be trying to follow out the schemes of their earthly lives and would try to make their hearers believe that they had found means,